Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosie. The show's available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And joining me in studio today, man, I'm always glad he's here. But we are going to be running the gamut here. We're going to be talking about, of course, there's a couple of new films. One that's a high profile. The other is foreign and Oscar profiled. And then we will be doing Dead People We Like, which will be running the gamut from Babette's Feast to Billy Jack. So it's just one of those shows. And here to help me sift through all of this is the Film Yap's Chris Lloyd. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. And yourself?
We get to call this work. This is kind of a job thing, so I'm enjoying it.
Me too. I always enjoy coming here and just hanging out at WFYI and, of course, with my good friend.
Thank you. And for the record, he's not fully dressed. Well, he's dressed, but not indie-style dressed.
Yes.
So sleeves are rolled up.
We were pre-recording this in the morning, and I actually just came from the gym, so I actually just changed out from a tank top. I didn't want to inflict my armpit hair on anyone.
And by the way, we really, really appreciate that. All right. So just to remind people, we have the critics calendar, which is different than the actual calendar and the academic calendar because we both have kids. But we are in that post-Oscar, pre-summer blockbuster lull.
And it's not much of a lull. We've got
Rampage
was supposed to come out April 20th. It was moved up to April 13th. And that, for me, is really going to mark the beginning of the summer movie season. And, of course,
are you
just
really?
Two weeks after that is Marvel Infinity War.
Oh, okay.
So,
and then Solo.
Yeah, and then Solo. It's always that first big movie. It was always the first. It used to be like the last Friday in May, then it creeped up, then it became the first Friday in May. And then the Fast and Furious movie started doing the last Friday in April, and that kind of just blew the gate. So now it's summer movie season, I know, really starts late April. Now, early April.
Yep. Yeah, I was going to go with Marvel before as the official one, but I guess Dwayne Johnson's got a little – is he taking Will Smith's spot?
Yeah, I think so, as the sort of the quirky, you know, comedic action hero. Because Will Smith kind of seemed to get bored with it, / we got bored with him doing it. So because
Rampage, and that was a trailer that came with Ready Player One, which we'll get to in a minute. But then the Die Hard looking thing where he's Richard III with the bad leg. Hi, Richard. He's set.
He's set
for the year.
Yeah, and so for those who don't know about Rampage, you remember it was, I think, maybe a late 80s, early 90s arcade game where you controlled either a giant wolf, a giant Godzilla, or a giant ape destroying buildings. It's another movie based on a video game, and we know, well, some of them have done okay financially, but there's still never been a really, really good video game movie, and we'll see how this one does.
And,
but I'm not
holding
out hope.
What a setup for this. So opening in theaters, the second film from Steven Spielberg in about 4 months. He is one of those that kind of does one for the studio and does one and does the one for himself as the prestige product.
So which one is this?
Well, The Post got a couple nominations. I think this is probably one of his more fun adventures. It's the film version of Ready Player One.
Yeah.
And the other reason why I had Chris on here is Chris has read the book. I have not. It's a very – let me see if I can do the pitch correctly. It's based on a very popular book set in the future about 30 years from now in Columbus, Ohio.
2045,
Instead of Tulsa because of the tornadoes. But it's a futuristic – but it looks kind of new, kind of old, grungy world where the alternative universe is – imagine the internet and alternate reality all kind of meshed into one gigantic video game.
Yeah. Yeah, I just said about, you know, there's never been a good video game movie. I'm not counting Ready Player One because that's based on a book supposing a world where most of important interactions take place in a video game virtual reality. So this isn't actually based – on an actual video game,
right.
So it doesn't count.
Okay.
So I read the book last fall at the suggestion of a friend who's a real, you know, tech guy, which is to say that he and I are in different tax brackets. He recommended it, and I really enjoy it. You know, the prose, the writing is not the best, but the ideas behind it are really inventive. And it's basically just the idea is in the fictional world around 2025, people invented this video game virtual reality called the Oasis, and it quickly sort of overtook actual reality in that, you know, people do most of their meaningful interactions in this world.
So
the kid, you know, goes to school in the Oasis. He doesn't go to school, and like everybody gets a free Oasis, you know, goggles and gloves and all the kit.
How's your Facebook page, by the way?
Okay.
See what we did there.
Yeah. But yeah, it's that idea of like sort of all the things that are we're doing, like video games, virtual, now the nascent virtual reality, social media. Imagine that just all being everything. So people live through their avatars in this world more than anything else. And needless to say, there are forces out there, nefarious forces, that want to – because, you know, now most of the world economy actually takes place through – the idea – they didn't go too much in the movie compared to the book, but, you know, it's basically, you know, the climate has just gone to heck and things are terrible and people would just rather live in that world than somewhere else. So, you know, they live in the stacks. Wade Watts lives in the stacks, which are literally trailers, you know, like
trailers.
Yeah, stacked on top of each other to make sort of these little mini towers. So, you know, the nefarious forces are there. And the idea is that the inventor of the Oasis, James Halliday, has died 5 years earlier, and he placed a Easter egg, a huge, massive quest line, and whoever finds the Easter egg gains control of the Oasis and essentially becomes the most richest, most powerful person in the world. And these evil guys are trying; they have like literally an army of avatars trying to do this, and no one's been able to get anywhere. And then, boom, out of nowhere, of course, the humble boy becoming a man goes on his hero's journey. And is the first to start unlocking the keys and the gates to this, and then it goes from there.
So I'm the one who has not read this. So I'm hearing little Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Last Starfighter, little Tron,
a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. The big thing, the big difference between there's a lot of differences between the book and the movie. Not in terms of, you know, they introduce a few characters that aren't there, they extract a few that aren't. Somebody dies who does, somebody doesn't die does. But the main way they change around is the actual quest that he goes on to go through this. They you know, truncate it, make it a lot simpler. Here they're just looking for three keys. In the book, you have to find the keys, then find the gates that they unlock. And the book is much more Dungeons and Dragons role playing.
Oh, good lord!
Your character, your avatar, literally has levels. You have to level up, and you get magic items and spells and all that kind of stuff. So the book is more, I would say, Dungeons and Dragons with a heavy patina of science fiction slathered on, whereas the movie is much more science fiction and not so much role playing.
Or in my case, the Dungeons and Dragons board game, because that was just one game and that was it. I couldn't dive into the huge
rolled a 20-piece die in games.
Oh, I was into that all through
really?
My high school.
Oh, so this is right up your alley.
Oh, yeah. I was into that through, like, age 9 to 18.
Yeah, I couldn't.
I will, for our viewers listening pleasure, will reveal the extent to my hardcore nerdism.
Oh,
is,
yeah.
Not very much since my kids were born, but still occasionally. I still have a hobby of painting the little lead figurines that you use with table Dungeons and Dragons, where, like, you know, like I'm a gnome illusionist, and so you have like a little, you know, 20 centimeter or millimeter high guy that you paint to do that. I still do that, even though I haven't actually played tabletop Dungeons and Dragons in, looks at his watch, 30 years. So, yeah, that's me. So, needless to say, you would think that a book and a game and a movie like Ready Player One, I would totally be into, and I was.
Well, as somebody who plays Tommy Wiseau interviews at least twice a year on his show, I have no place to make fun of your, you know, one man's nerdism is another person's different nerdism.
Yeah. It's a fun movie. It's also a movie that makes you think a little bit, you know, sort of about the things we're doing now, you know, and sort of like, you know, they've been talking about virtual reality and Google goggles and all this kind of stuff for 10 years at least.
Yep.
And it's never really kind of broken through, and this is sort of a cautionary tale of like maybe it's a good idea if it doesn't break through. Really, what the movie is it's going to appeal to millennials, but it's really more of a Generation X nostalgia tour. That's really what it is. It's a Spielbergian adventure in the highest sense.
So there's a lot of 80s references, and my guess is, and verify this, the creator of this world, you're kind of Jobsian, eccentric trillionaire, I mean, was a child in the 80s. That's why you see this kind of futuristic world, although the poor sections of the futuristic world look
right.
like today, but you do hear Van Halen and I think Pat Benatar.
Oh, yeah,
and the kind of a, you know, it, and it's also, there's a lot of 80s pop culture references. I mean, and it kind of digs deep, but it's not of the Wedding Singer, oh, the wacky decade, look at the clothes, look at the music, look at the movies. I think those of us of a certain age, like us, and without giving way too much, the clues are in 80s references that kind of run the gamut. One that I was familiar with, and then another one that was like, oh, we're going to go that deep into the history of the Easter egg. I'll just kind of leave it vague at that.
Yeah, well, it's in the book and it's in the movie. Is he's a Generation Xer born in 1975 within that fictional world, and so he loves 80s and, you know, getting into early 90s stuff. You know, when home video games were becoming a real thing,
right.
An era I remember very, very, very well. Yes,
I was
one of the first people to buy Pools of Radiance for my Commodore 64. still a great game. The idea is that the mystery is James Halliday himself. It's like the Oasis literally contains every cultural artifact from his childhood and being a young man. Literally all the movies, all the music. You just go in the Oasis and it's all there.
Big Brother was watching.
So it's clues from his own life. Not so much about him as about the things that he was passionate about during his life.
Right. And he's played by Mark Rylance, who is the current muse for Mr. Spielberg. And good for him on that.
I think this is his third or fourth in a row?
He wasn't in the post. But the BFG and, of course, winning the Oscar for Bridge of Spies.
By the way, the BFG...
underrated,
tragically ignored movie.
Yeah.
Wonderful
Go
family
rent
film.
It. Go rent it. What's wrong with you? What I liked about the film was good use of technology with the spirit of the 80s. And what I mean by that is there are certain films, and you see posters and there's reference to them, like, as I mentioned, there's, you know, Tron, The Last Starfighter. In fact, the intro of the boy going through his kind of trailer park had that Last Starfighter feel. Real genius. All the science, you know, My Science Project, and maybe maybe a little bit of weird science, but those type of films, the kind of teenage underdog pictures.
Yeah, lots of stuff like that. And needless to say, the movie itself contains a lot of Easter eggs.
Yes.
For the viewer. Literally the point where, like, this is a movie that, you know, when it comes out on video 6 months from now, you're going to want to like do
three
rewinds and free, you know, and yeah. freeze frames to catch it all. Because I mean, I was just seeing little things, you know, like in the background, all sorts of cultural references.
Yep.
The thing is, when I remember when I read the book, not knowing it was going to become a movie, and then I found out it was going to become a movie. There was a bidding war for the rights to this book in 2010 before it was even published, and. Immediately upon gaining that knowledge it was going to be a movie, what I said was, there's no way they're going to be able to get the intellectual property rights that are in the book to all the stuff. Because, like, he just, you know, he references, you know, this and that. And so I kind of knew going in, like, you know, we wouldn't get our Ultraman. I was really excited about having an Ultraman, but I realized it was probably not going to happen.
But you got Krull.
Oh, you got Krull. And the thing is, these aren't big things where, like, somebody says, hey, I've got the weapon from Krull, and I'm going to throw it. I mean, it's there, and it's like you either pick up what it is or you don't. My personal favorite little Easter egg in the movie, which I laughed out loud in the theater, and I didn't hear anyone else, so I don't know if anyone got it, was that there's a spell that plays a pivotal role in this, and the chant that is used in the movie for the spell is the same chant used by Merlin and Morgana...
Morgan Le Fay.
Morgana Le Fay. In the 1981 film Excalibur.
In John Boorman's Wow.
I don't know if anyone else caught that, but that's the sort of movie it is, where it's like, you know, you're going to be the one or two persons in your thing that gets a particular reference. And be like,
Oh, that should be your profile picture right there, that. And I know there was a big change, and I think part of it was, the other part is this is the film that's put out by Warner Brothers. And I know there's a plot point where one of the keys you go into... In the film, and it's actually one of my favorite sequences, and it works well. But you go into the Overlook Hotel from The Shining.
Yeah, that's not in the book.
I think it was War Games was in the book, which, by the way, is I think United Artists, so that's probably.
Yeah. So you can see, like, people would say, like, the studio that owns like the rights to War Games isn't going to sell it to a competitor for their big Spielberg movie. So you can kind of see the challenges there. But I thought they did a pretty good job of swapping things out. And I'll just say, like, you know, the intellectual property right that subbed in for Ultraman, I was not unhappy about.
I think I leaned over to you.
Well, let's just say he was metallic and large.
Yeah, by the way, and I know the current online snark about the film, and I know there's already a bit of a backlash, but I'm not gonna get into a whole lot, but the Warner Brothers gave the Iron Giant more love in Ready Player One than it did when the Iron Giant was actually released in theaters.
Yeah, it was 1999.
Yeah, kind of dropped the ball on that one. So fortunately, it's gained a cult following, and now it's getting hopefully. And actually, there could be a chance that, you know, younger people check out the Iron Giant because of this film. Maybe we'll see. Anyway, but yeah, the other thing that's kind of cool with the film is, for the most part, the kids kind of look like kids.
Yeah, that was something that was in the book that they tried to, you know, like, for instance, the female lead, you know, in the book is, you know, specifically described as not looking like your prototypical movie teen.
Right.
Which is to say, you know, thigh gap and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And she, you know, she's imperfect in her exterior and imperfect in her interior. And same thing with the guy. They didn't follow this in the book, but in the book, he's actually supposed to be like, you know, have bad acne and be overweight and stuff like that. And then through the course of becoming the hero of the Oasis, he actually, you know, loses weight and tries to grow up a little bit.
And he's played by Ty Sheridan, who I kept going back in, like, his first two credits. Yeah, not bad out of the gate. He was one of the boys in The Tree of Life, and he was also in Mud. And there's a couple things like that. Detours, A Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, Stanford Prison Experiment, which I remember watching. Hey, so it's a good job on him. Like I said, all the kids are kids. There is one guy I have to point out, and it's and I hope he gets to do a comedy really soon. And it's Australian actor Ben Mendelsohn.
Yes,
who studied the Paul Gleason / William Atherton School of 80s cinematic authoritative D-bags.
Yes, yes, with great hair. And he's kind of like the new Tony Houston.
Or Christopher McDonald.
Yeah, he was the bad guy in Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Oh, no, one of the most fierce members of middle management in Star Wars.
Yes, yes.
And the first thing I saw him in was Animal Kingdom. So kind of he's that guy.
Yeah, he's corporate D-bags. That's kind of his niche.
So yeah, so I'm hoping he gets to be a wacky dad in the comedy very soon. I mean, I'm sure he's doing very well financially with his current work.
You know what I would love to see him do? Just because I hate to see actors get pigeonholed or pigeonhole themselves.
Right.
I'd love to see him do like a romantic lead.
That'd be good.
You know, like that's the thing. It's like, you know, I've often said about when people get pigeonholed, like Hilary Swank. I would love to see Hilary Swank do a classic romantic lead, just because she kind of got pigeonholed as that.
You mean you P.S. Know. I Love You didn't? Well, nobody saw that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, she's kind of seemed like she's done as a movie star. Yeah.
Well, we'll have to keep at it. Anyway, so it's a fun film, and I actually wound up liking it more than I thought I did. And there are old codgers. Sometimes we are those old codgers that complain that movies look like video games. It's not a movie; it's a video game.
It's supposed to look like a video
game. Right. But in this case, yes, I think of like Zombieland. Zombieland is supposed to be a video game, and I talked earlier about the use of technology. The opening chase scene, basically the first game that you see, the first quest, is set in New York City, and you have not only New York and a ton of vehicles going up against the, you know, going in the same direction, but you also have as distractions King Kong and Godzilla.
Yeah.
And it kind of embraces that silliness right out of the gate. I didn't mind that. Obviously, it is a video game because it's supposed to be. And then you have a giant scene. You have a big epic fight near the end that, you know, you've seen from Troy and every other, you know, cast of thousands, or in this case, CG of thousands, where you see iron giants and other space beings and saucers flying into the fight, not just guys on foot.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. It's a really good adventure film. But like I said, it also has that layer of, you know, the sort of nostalgia. And I think it's the sort of movie that, like, you will think about in the days after seeing it and kind of ponder about where we're going with our technology and how we're letting it sort of drive our lives.
So there you go. That is opening in theater. And I think that's going to be around for a while. So I hopefully both people will check that out. Now, on the flip side, the other part of we talked about the post-Oscar drought, or, you know, the post-Oscar season that we're kind of in now. Although, like I said, we have good stuff out there. Did you see Unsane?
I did not see Unsane. Okay. That's the Steven Soderbergh filming on an iPhone movie.
Yeah, which is, and I actually like that more than I thought I would, and the use of camera works in the kind of committed feel of being in an institution. But there's also the other effect of the Academy Awards is the trickle down. So right now there's films that maybe were lesser known that are getting a little bit of an opening. And in this case, one of the films that was up for Best Foreign Film is now in theaters this weekend. It's a complete opposite of what we just talked about. From Russia, a film called Loveless, a story of a really ugly divorce. I mean, more than Kramer versus Kramer ugly. It is where the couple are still in the house. They still have their own mistresses, and they're not hiding this.
Yeah.
They're just waiting for the paperwork. They just want to sell the place and move on with their lives, and it's really unpleasant. And then their son goes missing.
Yeah, their 12-year-old kid disappears, and, you know, there's this layer of they really are upset about it. And, you know, they're trying to be focused on searching for him. And, you know, they join all these, you know, volunteer groups, like looking out in the woods and stuff. Or as to say in Russia, the trash filled, you know, outside of the cities.
Yeah.
But there's also this, you know, this sort of thing. We can see it weighing on them of this is just something else that's delaying what we really want to do, which is complete the divorce and get on with our lives. And, you know, just sort of weighing that. That feeling of just emptiness and hatred, and now you're having to have sympathy and trying to, you know, working with your soon-to-be ex-spouse. It's one of those movies. I put it in the category of like The Road, great film that not too many people saw, or 127 Hours,
film you don't want to see a second time.
Yeah, this film, and I keep meaning to do. I literally have this list of ideas to do a podcast that I've never gotten around to. This one is movies that are great but hard to watch.
Well, I know the Onion did one, or the IV Club did one a while back, so you have to put in Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah.
Anything by Lars von Trier.
Yeah, you know, like Million Dollar Baby. I think I saw it twice when it was in theaters. Loved it. Haven't seen it since, just because it's not this thing that's like, you know, Friday night with your wife or your spouse, and you're like, hey, let's pop in a movie. Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of film, maybe it's why those kind of films, you know, don't necessarily live on in video and streaming the way more fun films do. So Loveless is definitely not a fun film, but it is quite a good one. It wasn't, you know, for me, among the top foreign films I saw last year, but it was definitely a very good one. Now, I saw the film literally late November, early December, so it's been like almost 4 months that I saw it, so we leaned on someone from the Film Yap crew to review it for the site, and that was our good friend Bob Bloom.
Bob, by the way, I sat next to Chris and Bob at Ready Player One, and I was talking with Bob about this, and I did also like the film. It is very intense, and it's exhausting to watch, but in a good way. So, but yeah, Bob wanted to throttle these two people. He was really, really upset.
Yeah.
And Bob is one of the elders of the IFJA, so it takes a lot to really push his buttons.
Yeah, and I should mention Bob has his own website as well, realbob.com, so you can check out his review there or on the Film Yap where he has lovingly agreed to repost it. So if I will, I'll just read from Bob Bloom's review of Loveless. Loveless is not so much about finding the boy, but about how easily a person can be discarded or abandoned by parents who, because of their resentments and recriminations, already have moved on to new lives. Alexei, is the name of the boy, it seems, is collateral damage, a casualty of a two-person war. The director Zvyagintsev's movie can be seen as a metaphor about a nation that has lost its soul. Loveless is like the film. It's like the director's Mother Russia, cold, harsh, and unforgiving, devoid of feeling.
And gelatinous fish.
Yeah. Performances are superb. You walk away from the film filled with disgust for these self-centered and selfish people. At times, you sense as if they would be happier if Alexei was never found.
So, hey, that's out there. and this would be the type of film, sorry guys, this would be the type of film Bianca would want to watch while Kobe still wants to watch Jackie Brown. So.
Yes. So it's one of those, I do recommend this film. I'm not going to say that you're going to... You know, if you go see it at the art cinema, you might want to pop into the bar next door and have a couple afterwards.
And then go home and watch Bob's Burgers or Arch or something to cleanse your palate. You don't want to see Loveless and then go to bed.
Yeah.
That's a rough ride. So, all right. Lots of other titles going about. And I'm going to throw these by Chris one way, shape, or form because there's still plenty out there. Next weekend at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, April 6th and 7th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., there's a term we use in our house. My daughter uses it. I was directing Bourne yesterday, and she referred to it as men in suits talking. So that is a subgenre that we have at the house. And this is, for me, one of the greatest men in suits, women in gowns talking films of all time from 1950, All About Eve.
Oh, boy.
On a big screen. Gotta go. Get your gown with pockets.
Yeah.
And... that was the thing, because Emma wound up really loving it. And it's a great, nasty, not Loveless nasty, it's just beautifully written piece of behind-the-scenes showbiz Babylon.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you kind of see things through the eyes of a young person viewing this older person, and essentially through the course of the story, they supplant them in some way, and then, you know, start to display some of the same behaviors. It's one of those, you know, I'm turning into my dad, I'm turning into my mom kind of
thing. Right.
It's not a mother-daughter relationship here, but you get the idea of, one of the all-time greats.
Betty Davis, Ann Baxter, George Sanders, Celeste Holm. But yeah, that is happening next weekend, not this weekend, so mark your calendars on that. April 13th and 14th, the cult favorite, Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, yeah. I never
got into that.
I was never as big on that movie as other people were. I will say about that movie, I'm trying to remember the name of the filmmaker. He's only done he made one movie after that. His follow-up was a film that nobody saw called Gentlemen Broncos, which is a fun little quirky off-the-wall movie.
Jared Hess.
Yeah, Jared Hess. Hard to even describe. And such was the theatrical reception of Gentlemen Broncos that he didn't direct another film for 10 years.
Actually, his follow-up to Napoleon Dynamite was Nacho Libre.
Oh, I'm sorry. Nacho Libre,
that Jack
Broncos.
Black film where he falls down a lot?
Yeah.
That, and then Gentlemen Broncos. And
I would actually recommend people go check out Gentleman Broncos over Napoleon Dynamite.
Wow, look at you. So that is happening the 13th and 14th. Friday, April 20th, is a part of the Real Women Vintage Wine Series. I don't know. At 7:30 p.m., the first Bridget Jones's Diary.
The good one.
The good one, yes. April 21st at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m., it's a charity event called Cartoons for Cans, where they're showing an hour of classic Warner Brother cartoons with cans collected to the Interchurch Food Pantry. And then Saturday, April 21st, is part of the Brew and View series at 7:30 p.m., the first National Lampoon's Vacation.
Oh, boy.
Which I don't love it as much as others because I think Chevy Chase wears me out. And I think even then I knew he was an insufferable human being. But yeah, it's interesting how it's kind of deemed a classic, even though it's as a classic family film, even though it's got the National Lampoon's sticker on it.
Yeah, and remember the actor who played the son was one of those three name guys?
Anthony Michael Hall.
That
was one of his first things.
Yes, I remember all through my when he was a star, kid star in the 80s, that was the guy I was always compared to. It was like, I have the name of another movie star, but I looked like Anthony Michael Hall.
Oh, Paul Bettany.
Yes. Yeah. <wait.
laughs> Your favorite albino assassin.
Yes, which, you know, I was very offended about, but of course then I look at pictures of myself from back then, I was like, that's pretty weird.
Okay, so that all
And then we both got old and thick, and now I still look like him.
Shifting gears here. So anyway, all of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin at IU Cinema, depending on when you're listening to this. While you still have time, if you haul tail down at 3 o'clock on Saturday, and I've used this analogy before, but I still like doing it because it's my show. I use the original Inherit the Wind is Frederick March and Spencer Tracy. For me, that's the heavyweight boxing match equivalent of acting. Just two heavy hitters going at it. The undercard is Shatner Montauban. Because Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is happening at IU Cinema, and good for them for showing it on a big screen.
That is one of the most rewatchable movies ever made. I mean, even if you know... Some movies, like you see it and you see something else that you didn't even see before. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the case, but that movie never gets old.
Yep. So I have to eventually write this out and make it look like an old boxing poster. So you have March and Tracy, Montauban, Shatner. I think Streep, Hoffman from Doubt, that has to go in there. It also helps if you have a scene with the two actors just really, literally and figuratively butting heads.
Yeah. Frederick March is one of those names that, you know, unfortunately he doesn't get remembered like, say, Spencer Tracy or any other great all-time film actors does. I don't think your average movie person would know that name, but, you know, just
you
kind of from the 20s through the 40s, his heyday, The Life of Emile Zola.
The original Star is Born.
Yeah, yeah, just a terrific, terrific, one of those real, real chameleon-type actors.
And yes, and this one goes out to somebody else. I would say, no, that was Ray Milland. I was going to mention The Thing with Two Heads, but that's Ray Milland, sorry. Saturday at 7 o'clock at IU Cinema, the foreign film Oscar winner from last year, A Fantastic Woman, a very complex story.
One of my favorite foreign films from last year.
Yeah. It's another domestic situation, and it could be anywhere, because it's the family dealing with the death of the patriarch and the transgendered
mistress
who wants to attend and wants closure of her own but cannot because of the family. So.
Yeah, I think it's Chile. It's a very, very macho culture, and they can't really wrap, you know, they can't get back. It was bad enough that he was carrying, the husband was carrying on an affair. They can't wrap their brains the fact that it was a trans woman.
Yep. Monday, April 2nd, the 2016 documentary Melly Murals is part of the Asian Pacific America series. Thursday, April 5th, The Namesake from 2006 at 7 o'clock. Friday, April 6th, Man with a Movie Camera with Live Piano Accompaniment, the 1929 documentary.
Sergei Eisenstein?
I believe. Gesundheit, yeah. Actually, it was Ziga Viratov.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But I was, that was very, look, right, your pledge dollars at work. Saturday, April 7th, Symphony of the Donbass from 1931, and then Motherland from 2017 at 7 p.m. And then going down, just to mark your calendars, Thursday, April 12th will be a live lecture from filmmaker Mira Nair.
Oh, wow.
Along with, on Friday the 13th, Salaam Bombay, Monsoon Wedding, and Mississippi Masala. That's a full day right
there. That's a full day.
That's going to be really good. Also, mark your calendars. And shameless plug, I will be at this, so hopefully you will be as well. Wednesday, April 11th at 7 o'clock at the IMAX Theater downtown. Hi, Craig. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Oh, boy. That
very,
like
very exciting.
I think they're actually doing like a little mini Western series, aren't
because
they?
Of the real series
yeah.
that's happening at the Idlejorg. I believe sometime in June they're showing No Country for Old Men, so be on the lookout for that. Have you heard the Summer Night series at the IMA?
I've heard, yeah. Always a good lineup.
So just a reminder, June 1st, The Philadelphia Story. June 8th, But I'm a Cheerleader. June 9th, Bend It Like Beckham. June 15th, The Graduate. The 16th, Night of the Living Dead. Big Hero 6 on the 22nd. And A Shot in the Dark on June 29th.
That's an interesting choice.
There's some interesting choices in there. So anyway, and you can go to the full list at the IMA. Also, at the Irving on Saturday, April 14th, the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Well,
were you a Rocky Horror guy?
Yeah, never so much. You know, I mean, I enjoyed going and doing the midnight showing thing, but, you know, a couple times was enough for me to do that.
Okay. I went to a lot. I had, for me growing up, there was a theater in Utica, Michigan, which was kind of closer to Pontiac. But anytime I was, as a teenager, going to either a concert or a ball game in Detroit or Auburn Hills, the timing would be actually work out just right that I could go to this theater at midnight and watch Rocky Horror.
Oh, yeah. We do the midnight movie things. People, you know, is that, you know, during my high school, teen, and college summer years that I was an assistant manager of a movie theater.
So you had the midnight movie experience on the other end.
Yeah, although the thing is, we didn't do midnight movies at our theater.
Thank God.
We would have like our 10 o'clock show, close down our theater, make the bank deposit, go somewhere else to see a movie. We would go out to the Pleasure Island, and feel free to have your double entendres, which was on the Walt Disney World campus. Mm-hmm. They had a really big, nice theater there. So that was way down south. So yeah, you know, go out there for, they would have like, you know, 1:30 in the morning showings. Yeah.
Wow.
Get home at like 4 in the morning. Yeah.
Living.
Good stuff.
Those days. Okay, let's move. You're listening to Film Sociology, by the way, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Chris Lloyd of the Film Yap is hanging out with me. I think this is one of those shows we're not going to a break.
Don't need it.
Lot of energy here. New on DVD and Blu-ray. Well, the big one, I believe, Star Wars came out this week.
Star Wars The Last Jedi. Enjoyed it. A lot of fun. Great space opera. Easily, for me, the weakest of the now 9 Star Wars movies. And yes, I'm including
Ooh.
The prequels. I don't know what... I've often said that, you know, people mocked the prequels. Rightly so, for a lot of aspects. But, you know, there was a lot of great stuff in there, along with a lot of bad stuff. I was talking with another one of our fellow film yappers, Evan Dossey of the Midwest Film Journal.
You mean Mr. Paddington too?
Yes, and he, you know, he kind of asked me like, "Well, tell you know, like, you, what's your take on it? Why do you think Attack of the Clones is better than, say, Last Jedi?" And I said, "Well, you know, there's just a lot of great space opera in there. You know, literally, the only thing that doesn't work in that movie is the romance. But if you can compartmentalize and say, okay, other than that." What does work, it's a really, really good movie.
I remember Attack of the Clones having moments like a Raymond Chandler detective story, because there's a lot of going to diners and finding out info, and so there was a little bit of that.
You know, finding out that, you know, the stormtroopers and all of that military technology, the clones, were actually done at the behest of the Jedi's, not in opposition to them. Mm. That was a jaw-dropper for me in that movie. So I really enjoyed that. Movie's 2.5 hours long. The longest of the Star Wars movies, easily could have
sliced and diced.
They couldn't have just edited it. They needed to get rid of that whole Finn going off with Rose on that whole side quest that ends up being, you know, narratively a dead end. You know,
I think the Empire Strikes Back template is kind of used in this, where there's training stuff and sneaky stuff, and then the actual main conflict stuff. And yeah, it probably could have been trimmed, but it didn't bother me as much.
And you know, you can blow holes in any movie, things that don't work, especially science fiction movies. But you know, like this one, you know, the main storyline is dependent on the supposed fact that, I guess, in non-light speed, not in hyperspace, all spaceships move at the exact same speed, which is something we had clearly established was not true in the previous movies. So why it's suddenly true now, I don't know. That's just I hate things like that when movies, again, you can nitpick any movie, especially sci-fi, but I hate it when films just wear their flaws apparently proudly on their sleeves and don't even try to address them.
I wish Kobe were here because I don't have a sound drop of Ogre screaming, "Nerds!"
Yeah.
Or Patton Oswalt holding a filibuster in a Pawnee for his Star Wars series.
Yeah, but I like Star Wars because I've liked all the Star Wars movies, yeah, including The Last Jedi.
So there. And really nothing else is going up against that, even in home video.
People, yeah. I always am looking about, 6 to 8 weeks ahead on the home video to plan my column, and I could see that big wide open space there of nobody wanted to compete with Last Jedi.
However, there are two titles of note, at least for me, of note. The Criterion Collection has put out Ken Russell's Women in Love.
Oh, boy.
Which got, yes, as you know, this show is a fan of lunatic Ken Russell. This is... It looks like a, and of his films, this looks the most like kind of masterpiece theater,
yeah,
except for the nude wrestling scene.
I was going to say, with winkies.
It's Glenda Jackson winning her first Oscar for this. Glenda Jackson, Oliver Reed, Alan Bates, the other lady. And it's based on the D.H. Lawrence novel. And again, it's Lord and Lady B.S., which we've made fun of. It's a beautiful costume drama, but because it's Ken Russell, there's some little kinky stuff going on. And I would say of the Ken Russell canon, with the exception of The Boyfriend, the musical, a G-rated musical, this is probably the calmest, the sanest of Mr. Russell's work.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's out on Criterion. But the other film that I wound up checking out, because there has been a trend the last few years of starring vehicles for aging actors. And examples include Sally Field in My Name is Doris. Blythe Danner had one in I'll See You in Your Dreams, or yeah, something. I think that same director did one for Sam Elliott last year called Hero. For me, the best of the lot was Harry Dean Stanton's film Lucky, directed by John Carroll Lynch, which is an even streamlined, cut-down version of the same concept. Shirley MacLaine had one a while back.
I think it's called Last Word, or I think it was called The Last Word.
Something.
Where she plays a radio host.
That's right. So anyway, so it's from a respecting your elder standpoint, it's pretty cool.
Oh, did you say The Hero with
Hero with Sam Elliott?
With Hero, yeah. And I was that film really got overlooked during the awards cycle. I really wanted Sam Elliott to get a nomination. Unfortunately, people just didn't see it.
Well, and the problem, and I don't know which one of these came out first, but I saw Hero first. But new on video this week is a film called The Last Movie Star, with Burt Reynolds.
Oh yeah, I heard, and I was aware of this film, but
right, and this is one Reynolds plays and Vic Edwards, a Burt Reynolds-esque aging actor who was huge in the 70s, who, like Sam Elliott, is invited to pick up a Lifetime Achievement Award. And in Reynolds' case, in the Reynolds film, it's a film festival in Nashville. No, not that one, as it turns out. It's a fan festival by a couple of young 20-somethings. And quite often the template in these films, he is teamed up with a 20-something, in this case, his driver for the film festival, played by a very neurotic Ariel Winter, going way against type from her role in Modern Family. So it has and in this one, it's a mixture of, because Reynolds, he's walking with a cane, and it's a little uncomfortable to watch him struggle through this, but the man's still working. I mean, he's got, I think, 4 or 5 credits of films that haven't even come out yet. But there's also, so there's that element of he's grumpy and the younger person doesn't, and then of course they don't get along. And by the way, it's not a rom-com. They do not hook up. It's not James Woods or Peter O'Toole for that matter. But and of course there's a reconciliation and a bond that forms between the Reynolds character and the Winter character. The other thing that happens in this film, and man, we were talking earlier about getting permission from stuff for items for Ready Player One. There's a couple dream sequences where the old Reynolds character is in the Trans Am talking to the younger version of him. And then there's another one where he's in the canoe talking to the even younger version of him from Smokey and the Bandit and Deliverance. So,
but my big question is there like a toupee break line there where you can see the younger, you know, the
well,
pre and post toupee?
If you do pause, I'm sure you could, but no, they don't address that.
Yes.
But anyway, but kudos for, I mean, it's a labor of love. And it's Alan, Adam Rifkin, I believe, who did The Chase and a few other films and TV credits. If you go on IMDb, you'll see, you've seen his work. But this is, I don't know if this is a last hurrah for Reynolds. Like I said, he's got four films already lined up that haven't been released yet. But it's that kind of Valentine. And, you know, if and I think if Hero hadn't come out, I probably would have liked it even more because there's just similar plot pieces, period.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's he's looking for sort of a comeback, but I don't think so. But
well, he's 80 and brittle.
Yeah. Well, somebody who's due for a comeback is John Travolta, who's had the most up and down movie career of all time. Where, like, you know, he's been like the absolute biggest star in the world, then down in the pits, and he seems to just go through those periods. You know, where he was then up in the 90s, then down, then he was up for a little bit,
and he's got a new face.
He's been down for about, feels like about 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So he's due.
So we'll see, but. And by the way, I think Pacino needs another triple. I don't want a home. I don't necessarily need a home run from him or De Niro. A stand-up triple would be nice. But and I know De Niro got a nomination for Silver Linings Playbook a while back, but that
and
was
didn't
a while
deserve
back.
It. Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. So moving on. So that is out there. Oh, drive-ins are open. Drive-ins are open. It's March.
All right.
Depending on the weather. So at the Tibbs on screen one. Well, these make sense. Have I asked you the obligatory drive-in question? When was the last time you were at a drive-in? Do you remember?
It was before I moved up here to Indiana, so I did go to them when I was in Florida, so probably about 13 years.
Do you remember what you saw?
Oh, not the last one.
Okay.
Like, I remember I saw, like, Anna and the King there. And
wow, there's a drive-in fair.
Yeah.
Or,
no, I don't remember the last
okay.
one.
Or how about odd drive-in pairings?
No, I never did a
okay.
double feature.
That's fine. Anyway, Screen 1, Ready Player 1, Movie 2, Tomb Raider. So Alicia Vikander can run and grunt and jump and everything. That's cool. Screen 2, whoa, Tyler Perry's Acrimony with Taraji P. Henson.
Yes, that's coming out this Friday for Mr. I Don't Screen for Movie Critics Anymore.
Because we're terrible. The second one, Winchester, the Helen Mirren spooky movie.
Yeah, I missed that one.
It wants to be a Hammer horror film, but it was all right. Screen 3, Pacific Rim Uprising, the sequel to the Guillermo del Toro film, and this one's not directed by Guillermo del Toro, and apparently it shows.
Yeah, it's okay. It's got some fun parts. It didn't really classic did not movie that did not need to exist.
Right. And the second one, second feature, The Strangers Pray at Night.
Mm.
Screen 4, A Wrinkle in Time, or as somebody wrote, It's Annihilation for 9-year-olds.
Yeah, that is just a complete garbage movie.
Annihilation or Wrinkle in Time?
Wrinkle in Time.
Okay.
Just, you know, needs help approaching basic comprehensibility.
And the second film on screen 4 is Black Panther. So those are happening at the Tibbs.
Good movie. Not as great as people are making out. I'm sorry, Mr. Naser. I'm
My
sorry.
Gosh,
I've been like tainted with the spirit of Richard Probst. You know, I've got to say something nasty. I'm sorry.
But you're mobile.
Oh no! Hey, that guy has seen
we love
himself
Richard
around the state of Indiana probably more than both of us combined.
That's true,
so.
And his arms are stronger for it. Over at the Skyline in Shelbyville, you have Ready Player One and 12 Strong.
Oh.
Okay.
That was
so
a good movie.
Yeah, that was one not a lot of people saw.
No, not a lot of people saw it. It was good. It was good.
Okay, getting on to Dead People We Like, because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. And sometimes it's just, we don't plan these. These just kind of happen. French actress Stéphane Audran passed away at the age of 85. Probably best known for, she played Babette in Babette's Feast.
Oh, yeah.
From 1987. Also worked on
Cannibalism movie.
No.
Wasn't it?
No, not that one.
I'm thinking of something
it's
else.
Cinema. Yeah, this is art cinematic food porn, but not that type of porn. Not The Cook, the Thief, or Wife, or a Lover.
No, I'm thinking there's another one where there's like a Okay, forget about it. Sorry. I'll need to IMDb it.
That's fine. She also starred in The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeois. She worked with Bunuel. Anyway, a couple of things of note. Deadly Circuit, Le Choc, La Cage aux Folles 2. I forgot about that. Blood Relatives, Silver Bears. There was that. That might be a piece to work on of the foreign actors making their American leap in the 70s.
Yeah.
So she was sort of one of those. The Breach, Just Before Nightfall, The Unfaithful Wife. The other one who passed away is writer and actor Dolores Taylor, also probably best known as the wife of Tom Laughlin. For you fans of Billy Jack, her only credits are the Billy Jack films.
Wow!
So yeah, I quick search, but she wrote and starred in all of those. So you had the Born Losers, which people never forget that. Then you had Billy Jack, The Trial of Billy Jack, and Billy Jack Goes to Washington. I'm not making these titles up, and I was telling Chris before, I found the Billy Jack box set on DVD for $20 in Bloomington. I own the entire Billy Jack filmography.
The oeuvre.
Yes, you're welcome.
The only thing I remember about the Billy Jack movies is how orange the blood was.
yeah. And this was, I'm surprised somebody hasn't tried to reboot Billy Jack in these times.
Well, I think
the white male being the oppressed.
I think they're doing that they're just too cheap to pay for the rights to Billy Jack.
I see. Well, there was Death Wish.
Yes.
And nobody asked for that. But it spoke to a certain audience in the 70s and made a lot of money for Laughlin. And by the way, all of the films have commentary by Tom Laughlin. He is of the Pete Rose, Denny McClain world of being misunderstood.
Oh.
And everybody hates him.
Oh,
it's
boy.
One of the makes Coppola seem passive. Because if you listen to any Coppola commentary, he was on the brink of being fired all the time.
All the time.
Even when it was successful. Anyway. But yeah, so if you want to go check out Billy Jack, you come over to the house. I have him. Okay. So heading back to the Film Yap, where you can get a little of this and a little of that. One of my favorite ones that and Chris is responsible for is the Reeling Back column. And the one you had before this, if I remember right, was a little streak of films that has always fascinated me. The Burt Lancaster Western trilogy of Lawman, Valdez Is Coming, and Ozana's Raid. And you did Valdez Is Coming based on the novel by film sociology guest Elmore Leonard. and he plays a Mexican character. But it was the 70s, and he's a good actor. So we kind of cut him some slack.
The character was supposed to be Mexican-American, so a half-breed, as they refer to him in the movie.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember my exact wording there, but the people erroneously refer to him as a sheriff. I think he's actually supposed to be like a constable.
Yeah, middle management.
Yeah, and literally only of the Mexican half of this border town.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny how, he starts out the movie, he's very meek and deferential to all the white characters.
But we know it's Burt Lancaster.
And he used to be a Buffalo soldier and a bad tushy. I make reference to the particular weapon that he used. Which I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's this sort of fearsome rifle that actually came out prior to the Civil War and was just famous for, being accurate up to 1,000 yards. And, this is during a time where, like, most gunfights played out at 10 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Just a really, not necessarily a great film, but I just think a really fascinating one.
And Lancaster made these three Westerns together. Lawman is probably the most conventional of the three. He's up against Lee J. Cobb, Valdez we talked about. And Ozana's Raid is kind of this dark revisionist Western directed by Robert Aldrich, where the white man is really the bad guys in this one. We should never forget that. Anyway, but that was last time. This time around, you have a film. I remember seeing the trailers, of course, creep me out in 1980. And it was, I think, a reaction to the dumb teenager slasher movies of this time. But you did the film The Changeling, Scott and Peter Medak directing.
Yeah, which most people, I doubt, have probably ever even heard of.
Oh, that's not the case on this show. But
this film actually swept the first awards, the Canadian awards that are equivalent of the Oscars.
Yes.
Including with the actor George C. Scott winning Best Foreign Actor, because in Canada, if you're American, you are a foreigner.
And by the way, in Canada, Budweiser's an import.
Yes. And I, you know, as you know, I work pretty, try to work pretty far ahead on the, the.
So you watched this in what, like November?
It was probably about 3 months ago. Uh-huh. Yeah. It gets better as it goes. I wasn't a particular fan of it. The first hour is literally, you know, he plays a, it's supposed to be based on what happened to a real playwright in the 60s. It's supposed to be a composer in this version. And the idea is that he, terrible accident, loses his wife and daughter, moves out to the West Coast to sort of forget it all. He gets, becomes a professor, and they ensconce him in this massive, massive old mansion where no one has lived for 10 years because bad things happen there.
And by the way, the idea of George C. Scott as a composer is terrifying, because I think he would rip a piano apart with his bare hands if the piece wasn't working.
Yeah, but like literally the first hour of this movie is just George C. Scott wearing an omnipresent sweater vest. Puttering around the house, and you know, like the, you know, something
with house noises,
with house noises, and you know, quizzical one raised eyebrow. That's the whole freaking movie for the first 45 minutes to an hour, and man, it does finally get going along. And there's one scene in it that's genuinely horrifying, which I won't give away, but involves a young man in a bathtub.
Yep, and Melvin Douglas.
Yeah,
sort of.
And this is, I think this was second Melvin Douglas's second to last. Because
there was Ghost Story, which had – that was the old – really the old Codger horror film with – I think it was him, Fred Astaire, and I – oh, God, John Carradine, I believe. I'll have to check on that. But I'm now reading from the Film Yap. The changeling is the stodgy uncle that wants to hang out with the cool kids, knowing the words but not the music. And
that's a line, by the way, that Roger Ebert often used in his reviews that I repurpose from time to time. That means lovingly honor Chaz Ebert, not steal.
Yes.
No lawsuits needed. It was an interesting film just because, you know, horror films really were taking off around that time. Like, you know, 78, I think, with
Halloween.
For me, Halloween was when things really, really got going. And this was sort of, you know, getting into that realm of the supernatural horror films, Exorcist, Amityville, Poltergeist, and this film kind of landed right in the middle of those. So it's just, to me, it was, I wanted to write about it because it was more, even though I didn't like the film, it was more interesting as a cultural artifact.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, the film I was thinking of, Ghost Story, 1981, Fred Astaire, Melvin Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and John Houseman.
Wow.
Craig Wasson is also in that. Patricia Neal. Yeah, this
Patricia Neal.
Directed by John Irvin, 1981, and I think this was, So Melvin Douglas went from being there, The Changeling, Tell Me a Riddle, which I remember seeing in the theater, that was with Lee Grant, The Hot Touch, which I never saw, and Ghost Story. So anyway, those are out there. Go to thefilmyap.com to check things out. We actually have a pretty good bloom of movies that are out in theaters. So go check that out if you get a chance.
Yeah, Patricia Neal, by the way, one of those wonderful actresses from the golden age that she kept working. Always been kind of a little bit in love with her.
I would say I'm gonna word is scary because I'm actually gonna be doing a interview with an author about The Graduate, and I know I've used. Anne Bancroft is the original origins of the cinematic MILF. I might think Patricia Neal in HUD.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, so.
Not people know. She was married to the author Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl, yeah.
And she had the terrible health crisis, I think in the early 60s, and he, you know, basically nursed her back to health, and wonderful love story, and then later he dumped her, but...
But we don't think about that.
We're not about that part.
All right, go to thefilmyap.com. Go check things out, but there's plenty out there. Chris, always a pleasure to hang out.
Mine as well, sir.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Oh, by the way, Soylent Green's People, Zard Has Spoken. Hi, Ed. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. And the Oscar stuff is on video. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. We'll be right back.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!